I'm recording.
All right. And I look at him right
now. Yeah, you can talk to me about him. But I guess let's start with this last term. We saw a number of significant decisions. Evers versus Mark Glein had one and two with the stewardship and joint finance oversight, and this most recently with the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules. We saw things having to do with the Attorney General and his ability to settle civil lawsuits. We saw stuff with promulgating rules for the spills law and whether they had to go back and redo all this. Is there a way to summarize like how significant all these cases are together in terms of really reapproaching that balance of power?
I think that the cases that the court has been deciding is certainly, if not redoing, but clarifying the responsibilities of the branches of government. We didn't used to have those kinds of cases for the most part. And so I think, you know, the legislature, primarily and Attorney General, just sort of developed their own process and belief, and people accepted that. And because of the tension, I think, between the parties, there's much more attention to, you know, if you make an appointment, how long can the person serve, or, you know, does the governor have the authority? We used to have some of the governor, you know, attacks on both Governor Thompson, I know, and Governor Walker. But I think that both at the national level and particularly at Wisconsin, there is a redefining and shifting of what people thought was the balance of power, what the court is saying is now the balance of power. But as the court changes, you never know where the next step's going to be.
Justice Hagedorn, in one of the oral arguments, called the Joint Committee for the Review of Administrative Rules kind of a gentleman's agreement, saying it may not fit the definition of the Constitution of the vested powers, but everyone just kind of agreed that that's the way it was. And there have been a couple of court cases since then, Martinez significantly, that have kind of upheld that framework. What does it take for a court, besides a shift in a majority, to come through and say, well, we need to really look at this from the ground up of whether this is even legal in the first place?
Well, I do think as the parties and the issues tighten and become much more contested, that's really when the court has to step in. You know, and so there are a lot of things that are habit or the way we always have done it or the informal rules. And as long as everybody's sort of agreeing to it, it works. But ultimately, I think that, you know, the parties are much more partisan. There's much more, it can be close, the votes on things. And people at the legislative level want to have control. And the Attorney General wants control and the governor wants control. And as a result, that sort of bubbles up to the court. And the court, I think, for the most part, has to tackle those things. I mean, they either have to say there's a justification for it, not just a gentleman's agreement or party's agreement. There has to be a constitutional legal justification, or if not, we're going to redefine it.
I think one of the things that jumped out at me looking at all these cases is that they weren't often the 4-3 split you might have expected. Some of these were 7-1, or 6-1, or 7-0 in terms of like, no, this is not constitutional.
Well, I think this past term, and I've talked about this, was interesting in terms of the splits on the court. And certainly in this area is one area you see it. I think there's a belief in our greater state that everything is 4-3, depending on who's in control of the court. And you look at the number of cases, particularly the second part of this term that came out, that were unanimous, 7-1, 6, you know, 6-1, and split, and then odd bedfellows on top of it, you know, so you'd have people that you'd think would be together who are not together. And so I think that's healthy. I was glad to see that, because I think a court that is totally predictable is really a court that looks like a legislature.
And that is a lot of what was being discussed, was who holds the, I mean, this is kind of a great civics class of a term. It's like the balance of power between the legislative, the executive, and the judicial coming in and deciding what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah, I think as our civics lessons have faded out in high schools, and a lot of people don't understand the three branches of government and the independence of the judiciary and how they balance and checks and balances. I think these cases are really doing a sharp analysis for people that there's conflict. I mean, that's the whole idea of the government, is that there's conflict and the court is overseeing the legality and the constitutionality of what the other branches are doing. And I think that's healthy, that people at least that are paying attention see that that's how our democracy was built. I don't like it when it shifts too often. That's my concern. And, you know, it happens at the federal level and sometimes happens at the state level, that the court has decided a case and then a year or two later it decides it in a different way, because I think that's a problem. But defining things for the first time in a new way, I think is very healthy for the court and it's healthy for our democracy.
So in speaking about that precedent, because especially for JCRAR, there was the Martinez decision, and I think it was a Planned Parenthood one. I forget the exact case, or maybe there was one just a few years ago in post-COVID that re-examined that same issue,
yeah.
Or post-lame duck term, that re-examined some of those same core issues, and both of them found that the review of administrative rules and legislative oversight was constitutional. So what does it mean when we see that many decades of precedent thrown out or upended over this?
Well, I always called myself a conservative judge because to me, conservative is honoring precedent if you can, or if not, to move very slowly and change it. And the reason I feel strongly about that is that society, business, individuals, law enforcement can adjust, you know, to whatever the opinion is. If you're swinging from side to side, it really is disruptive for everybody. It's disruptive for the economy, for knowing what your role is and things. And so, I don't like to see that happen. I understand why it does. And maybe, you know, I mean, philosophically, I may be happy it changed, but I worry about the fact that the court swings too far and really causes chaos on those other branches.
And so the review of the administrative rules and to some degree the spills law, the DNR's ability to enforce PFAS legislation or create new standards without having to go through the rules process each time, that one seems to be the most, the most widespread concern as to this could redraw the landscape out there. And conservatives on those committees are saying, we now have no oversight. We have no ability to stop unchecked administrative executive power.
Right.
And it's Democrats saying, well, you were the one stonewalling it in the first place. So is it ever relevant to look at what caused this or who's to blame for how we got to the point where it needed to be looking at this? Or is it just looking forward?
Well, I think the court knows what's been happening. I don't know that because of whose fault it is, should control how the case comes out. But it's a better understanding of how this arose, and it may give you a better understanding on how you can lawfully interpret it and not have a complete overthrow of some principle. And so I think that the court doesn't live in a vacuum. The justices read the newspapers, listen to the news, and certainly know what's going on. But ultimately, that's not their role. Their role is to say what's constitutional, what's legal. The whole issue, and that, again, it's a federal level and a state level of the administrative agencies and who oversees them and who has control and what the level of deference the courts have to pay to those rules has been in controversy for a number of years. And, it's swung a little bit one way or another, but I think we're heading now to saying we're not going to give the agencies the kind of control they've had in the past. I think that the court has really tried, Wisconsin Supreme Court has tried to be conservative in the sense that it's moved slowly on those issues, and partly because of the divisions on the court.
So in terms of the review of rules, the legislature was accused of having basically a pocket veto, where they could permanently uphold any rule as long as they wanted. Most of that came from the lame duck laws passed at the end of Walker's term, which were expressly designed to hamstring the Evers administration coming into power. That came to a head. But now the Republicans are saying removing all of that oversight means now that there's basically, they're saying that the administration's going to be a little pocket legislature, that these agencies can create whatever rules they want. is it ever the role of the court to look at like what could happen on the other end if they have to rule that way?
Well, that's not the lens in which they look. You don't look at it through a lens of what could happen, but the court considers that. You know, often when you're trying to draft an opinion, how you write it is as important as how it turns out. And the court is mindful of, you know, not wanting any branch to totally overpower another branch. And so it may be a matter of how the decision is written as to whether or not, you know, the legislature is going to have some control over this. The legislature has control. They create the budget, they make the money, they provide the guidance, and then the agencies make their decision. And the question is, can you have this small group of legislators then throw it out at the end? And I think the court reached the right decision in that case, that there really was no authority for them to have that kind of veto. But maybe, you know, and I haven't looked at this, but maybe there's some way for the legislature to ensure something else at a different point. And that's where you have to read the opinion carefully to see whether the court gave you some leeway on something else.
Yeah, for instance, we've seen with the stewardship fund being right. In the oversight of JFC and the, you know, anonymous vetoes and holds, that Republicans are trying to redraft that bill, but in a new way to still give them some oversight.
Right.
And, you know, we've seen Republicans change how they write the budget to out of fear of the way the governor's veto pen can work. Is it going to be that going forward we'll just see more creativity with, you know, those decisions in mind?
Well, I think that's what happens on decisions that particularly upend what people have been doing. And I think that what happens is that the branches get more creative and they look at the court or what the court has said to see if there's a way they can craft something to be able to do it. And that's what the court's role is ultimately, to take a look at it and to see whether it's constitutional or not. But that's how it's supposed to work. And, you know, it's that's why the decision itself is as important as the holding, because the holding just tells you what happens to the parties or this issue. But how the court set it, what tests it set up, those tests are really critical for people to say, what can we do? How can we do this? And ultimately, I think government works best when there is creativity and negotiation. you look at, wasn't this term, but the gerrymandering case, the whole map drawing case, you know, and there's obviously great controversy and upset when the court decided to throw out the map and we're looking at these others. But ultimately, everybody agreed on their map that the court didn't have to decide. And to me, you know, then it was unimpeachable, it couldn't be appealed. And, you know, I just think the government works best like that. And then, you know, then the court will have to look ultimately if it still meets the test.
You mentioned before that taking a conservative approach judicially just means moving slow, limited impact. And I'm thinking of Justice Hagedorn's, in part, you know, yeah. Dissent and his agreement with the decision that, you know, he would have found the one as moot, and then the other one would have gone into effect, and then kind of leave it at that, not upturning precedent. I mean, that seems to be that middle ground, and I think a lot of people do look in any of these cases, where's Hagedorn first, to see if it feels like a partisan split or if it's where he sits.
I hold Justice Hagedorn in the highest regard. Because, looking at his opinions, he very much understands the role of the court. And so, you know, you could tell his judicial philosophy and, you know, some of your political philosophy seeps in, and he's a conservative, but he understands the role of the court is different than the role of legal counsel to the governor or a legislator. And as a result, not everybody on his side wins, you know, and I think he writes very thoughtful opinions, whether it's a dissent or a concurrence or the majority, as to why he's doing that. To me, that's what you want from a judge, is you want somebody who looks at it through a legal lens and a constitutional lens and not a political one.
So Republicans are saying that the new fear here is unchecked administrative power. If that happens, their only way to go about anything will be to file lawsuits, right?
Right.
I mean, it'll end up back in the court. So does it ever occur where the Supreme Court gets a second crack to try and say, oh, maybe we went too far? Or is that happened in the
There are times that the court does a reconsideration of a decision because things happen that they didn't expect to happen. Now, that is, I can't think of a constitutional place where that's happened. But certainly in the development of common law or interpretation, the court writes an opinion and then hears and sees that it's gone wild somehow. The court will, and not infrequently, a few years later, take the case back in some other permeation. But that's one of the things the court has to evaluate when it looks to take a case. Is the next case going to fit to, you know, address the issues that you're concerned about? But they certainly have, you know, they have narrowed a decision or broadened it or reinterpreted it. And that's something the court does, and particularly when you have unintended results. You know, as a justice, we always try to think of every way that the decision could impact any area of the law. You know, we kind of play devil's advocate. Well, what about this area? What about that area? Could this be interpreted for that? And even the questions in oral argument are often that. How would this apply to broad base? But there are always going to be times that no one foresees where somebody takes it. And so it is part of the role of the court to reconsider it and say there's a problem out there. We ought to at least take a look at it. And maybe they just reaffirm the prior decision, but do a new reexamination of the issue.
I know that you'll be shocked to hear that there might be hypocrisy in politics, but at the state level, we have legislative Republicans who are very worried about unchecked administrative authority. And at the federal level, we have Democrats worried very much about unchecked administrative authority. And neither one of them seems to understand that it's completely opposite of what they're asking for and based entirely on what party or one person is in charge. And I mean, should we laugh at them? Can we call them out for that? Or is that just the nature of politics?
Well, I think the worry of legislators, both federal and state, in terms of what the impact is, often reflects how they feel it's going to impact tomorrow. There's very little foresight in these discussions about what happens if the other party gets control. And we see that happening, right? We saw that happening at the state level where, you know, a governor is given a lot of authority and then suddenly a governor of the other party has it and then they don't like it. And so, I think that is the nature of the tension between the parties. I wish legislators would be looking a little bit down the road and say, what's the best for the country or what's best for the state? But it really is, you know, what's good for us tomorrow.
So looking broadly at the state of the court, there's been upheaval since, you know, Janet Protasiewicz won mm-hmm. and the majority did shift. We've seen, you know, two new chief justices,
right.
Anne Walsh Briley was there temporarily. But going forward, what is the state of the court in your opinion? I mean, given your long understanding and history of it, can you put some context for people who do look too much in the moment?
Well, you know, one of the things I've said to people that when you look at the court, every time it gets a new justice, there's a shifting. You know, everybody has to sort of take a look at where they are and, you know, and there are some alliances and some issues that develop so that the personality of the court can change, the interactions can change. And I'll give an example, a very historical example. Chief Justice Shirley Abraham said before she was chief, and Justice Day, Raleigh Day, who became Chief Justice, did not have a good relationship when I was on the court. It was very clear, it was pretty open. And then when Justice Day became Chief Justice, and he was going to do it for 1 year until Justice Abrahamson was going to take it over, he decided he was going to change what was happening. So he was going to work towards civility. We suddenly were going out to lunch once a week at the Madison Club. We were trying to be respectful to each other. And both Shirley and Raleigh rose to the occasion. I mean, it just was a different court. And so in terms of interaction and personality, that can have a significant change. You know, what's important is you get the kind of judges who can respect people who disagree with them. And we've had some problems with that in the last several years where, in my view, particularly dissents have become very nasty towards other justices. That strikes at the heart of collegiality. And I think that And so we, Ann Walsh Bradley has been an incredible member of the court for a long time, for 30 years. She's got all the historical knowledge of the court. She was there when I was there. That's going to be a piece that's missing from that court. I mean, the rest of the justices are relatively new compared to that. And so there's going to be some adjusting in terms of power and information, and we'll have to see where it goes. I'm always hopeful that the court will become more collegial, even if they totally disagree on their opinions, and that people can have faith in the decisions that come out of that court.
And we've got, bang, 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 a lot of judicial elections coming up in the next few years. We're in the thick of every year these are coming up. Does that impact a court in one term, knowing that one of their members is up?
Elections impact a court. There's no question. I'm just going to back up for a moment so people understand. We are different. Wisconsin's different than other states, that we only allow one justice to be up at a time. So places like Iowa and others, you suddenly can have three people that are off and have three new justices, which really could create chaos. Our founding fathers were wise, I think, to say only one comes up. But particularly where people have a perception, and then justices too, that you have a conservative branch of the court and a more progressive branch of the court in terms of philosophy, that shifts when somebody key is up. This next year, that's not going to happen. It's going to be, as people perceive from the outside, a 4-3 split. And it could become a 5-2 split, but that won't create the swing that we had over Janet Proce, which is election. It doesn't affect the court in what cases it takes or timing of cases. And I think the court, I know when I was there, and I believe it's still that way, the court tries really hard not to issue opinions or decide opinions according to the clock. Who's going to be here? Can I delay it till the fall? Can I? And that really doesn't go on. I think that's sort of a fundamental view for the justices, and they pretty well follow it.
It's one last question having to do with the national thing. You mentioned redistricting.
Right.
Obviously, there is a national issue of a redistricting with Texas and some other blue states looking at doing it right now. Wisconsin's court recently said no again to redistricting our federal congressional seats. In your view, is that the right approach? Are they trying to send a message to stay above the fray, or are they looking for technicalities to not have to wade into it? So there were a lot of voters who voted for Protasiewicz and Crawford for their progressive intent that might be disappointed that they're not delivering on what they thought they were getting.
Well, one of the things when they deny taking it at a certain time is you don't know why. And it could be a lot of different reasons. My guess is it wasn't timing. It might have been, this case isn't in the right position. It has to be, more issues have to be decided by the lower courts before it comes to us. So it's like the U.S. Supreme Court issuing a lot of these, interim decisions where nobody knows what the rationale is. I think that issue will bubble up again. The court will probably face it again, and maybe it'll take it next. It'll be a new justice, and so maybe the court will take it. But I think, it's hard, courts decide to take and not take cases for lots of different reasons, and it isn't always because they don't want to tackle the issue.
Okay. Anything else that you'd like to address?
No, I'm pretty thorough.
All right. Well, thank you so much for giving us time.
You're
really welcome.
You're welcome.
Great.